You're listening to Speaking Of by WFSU Public Media. The Water, Wind, Fire Conference is a scientific gathering that will cover a breadth of topics about natural science in the Big Bend region of Florida. We're borrowing an episode from our sister podcast, Coast to Canopy, where host Rob Diaz de Villegas sits down with a panel of guests to discuss the upcoming sessions.
Water, wind, fire. Technology is changing the way we perceive the natural world. And yet, despite resources such as cutting-edge imaging, artificial intelligence, and mountains of data, researchers still have to be able to make sense of it all. This is one theme of the Water, Wind, Fire Conference. I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas with WFSU Public Media.
So joining me in the studio today, we have Dr. James Dunbar. He's the board chair of the Ocilla Research Institute and the former state archaeologist for the state of Florida. Welcome, Jim.
Good to be here.
We have Ryan Truchelet, the co-founder and chief meteorologist of Weather Tiger, a Tallahassee agricultural meteorology expert witness and hurricane forecasting company. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Jenny Rogers, a remote sensing and geospatial technology analyst with Tall Timbers Research Station and Land Conservancy.
Happy to be here.
All right. Great to have you all here. I'm looking forward to this conversation. So let's talk about the conference first. It's primarily an archaeological conference.
Well, no, actually it isn't.
No, okay, yeah.
It's trying to look at it's sort of archaeology, but it's also natural sciences.
Yeah.
And it's trying to look at the Big Bend area and how it developed through time and basically looking at the environment, the vegetation, the animals, the people, and how things changed through time. But it involves a lot of geology. It involves multispectral imaging. It involves weather forecasting and those type of things. And one of the reasons we decided to go on the theme of water, wind, and fire is the last three hurricanes that have hit here. We've had some wildfires. And I thought it would be a good time to address sort of a broad spectrum of different topics that are all related in a way, but they're not related directly to each other.
In the discipline of archaeology, I mean, you draw upon all of these different other disciplines too. I mean, it's all very heavily intertwined, right?
Right. It's as much as we can bring to the context of things, the better off we are. And what I mean by that, if you find an archaeological site in the middle of nowhere and you have to draw on, well, what are the diagnostic artifacts? That gives you a sense of time, but also, well, how did these people live? And if you have a place where you can core for pollen and get that kind of information, bare earth LIDAR may give you some kind of information of structures at the time. But we have somebody that's a geologist out of Canada that's going to come and talk. And Brendan Fentry, and his interest is looking for weather conditions in ancient times. And he's found some evidence of hurricane activity in Florida 12,500 years ago or so.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, you know, we have a variety of speakers, and it should be a very interesting kind of conference. And for archaeology, we'll try to use everybody's everything to try to make sense of what happened in the past.
Right, right. And before we get into all the different presentations, which are a really interesting and diverse lineup, talk about, you know, why Monticello is an ideal place for a conference, the first Floridians conference. Talk about sort of the rich, I guess, archaeological record around that area.
Well, we had the first conference, 2012, I can't even remember the year, tell you the truth, but we had just come off of doing investigations at the Page Latson site, drowned site in the Ocilla River, had immaculate preservation of plant remains, of animal remains, you name it, it had it. So that first conference sort of looked at Page Latson, but not only that, all the other early sites in the Americas that we could get our hands on. And from there, it sort of branched out, and we were trying to really, not only archaeology, but the earth sciences. That's what the Ocilla Research Institute is really trying to promote. and conservation in this area of rare and endangered resources.
Yeah.
Like the American mink. Did you know there were mink in here? Well, yeah, there are down near the coast. Mm-hmm. They're endangered. Why hurricanes? So it all ties together in a funny kind of way.
Right, right. And I just want to follow up on the Page Latin site. For our listeners, and I know a lot of people in this area know the Page Latin site, but for those who don't, and anyone who's listening to this as a podcast around the country, talk about the significance of the Page Latin site.
Well, at the time, I was working with a fellow, David Webb, who was a paleontologist, and myself and some archaeologist, and Lee Newsom, who's a paleobotanist, and things like that. And we really pieced together, it's not an occupation site, it's more like a human activity area that took place in the Isola River when the water tables were lower. We think they butchered a mammoth. We have cut marks on a tusk and some other things. And it was 14,500 years old, which caused all kinds of consternation in the community of archaeology because everybody knew and nothing could be older than 13,000 years. And here we're at 14,500. Since that time, there have been other discoveries. White Sands National Park is the famous one that dates from, I think, 24 to 23,000 or 22,000 years old. Human footprints followed in the tracks of like giant sloths. They were hunting the animals. And it's fully carbon datable because there are seeds that were in the sediment and that kind of thing. And there's been two major studies done now that say that's a real archaeological site. So getting into my end of things, why is that important? Because they were saying that people couldn't have been here longer than 13,000 years ago because the Cordillerian and Laurentine ice sheet closed off and there was no path to come into the Americas. Well, if people were here in the late glacial maximum, they were already here. And I think we're going to find human occupation sites or activity sites somewhere in the Americas that are dating to the 30,000 range.
Wow.
I think that's a high possibility now because at the late glacial maximum, maybe people weren't coming in because the Cordillerian and the Laurentine ice sheets blocked off everything. But they were already here is the point. So anyway, it makes it interesting.
Right. So let's go around the table. Let's talk about you guys' presentations. Ryan, let's talk about our Florida climate. So what's your presentation about?
So I'm going to be looking at both the climate of North Florida and potentially how it is changing with an eye towards climate extremes, impactful weather. You know, in the last 2 years here in Tallahassee, we've had the warmest month in Tallahassee history, August 2023. That ended with the first major hurricane landfall ever in Appalachian Bay, Idalia. We then followed that up with the most impactful tornado outbreak in Tallahassee history in May of 2024. We followed that up with the first Category 4 hurricane landfall ever in Appalachian Bay in Helene. And we wrapped it all up with probably the most impactful winter and ice storm that we've ever had in January of 2025. So no rest for the weary as a forecaster and as a meteorologist. But I want to put those kind of extreme events into a historical context because, you know, we have a long historical record that we can look at here in North Florida. We've got good temperature records going back to the late 19th century. We've got records of snowfall. We've got records of hurricane landfalls that go back 175 years in a very rigorous way. And we've got hundreds of years more data, you know, kind of in piecemeal from, you know, writings and paleotempestology, which is digging up sediments and looking for layers indicative of historical landfalls. So I'm going to be looking at what we can expect from the climate of North Florida. What is it? What are the influences that shape our weather? It's a fascinating place meteorologically because Tallahassee is right on the cusp between, on one hand, to the north, you have a continental climate. Continental climates tend to be hot in the summer, cold in the winter. Cold air is generated from basically air over land masses for long periods of time. So you can have extended periods of time when there's not a marine influence on the weather here in North Florida. On the other hand, we're 20 miles from the Gulf, and the Gulf has warmed with time. We're much warmer now than we were 30 or 40 years ago, and that is a subtropical and even a tropical influence on our weather. So I'm going to be going back and looking at all those forms of impactful weather, like extreme heat, extreme cold, snow, ice, hurricanes, tornadoes, droughts, and looking at the all the influences on that from the perspective of both diagnosing it, you know, how does El Nino, how does La Nina come into play and modulate those risks, and how are those risks changing with time?
Right. And so we've had more extreme events, but in general, you know, Florida, where we are right now, North Florida is, you know, we were talking before about, you know, we typically would have had more 100 degree days than any other place in Florida and more freezing days than any other place in Florida. So we're already in sort of, even before you factor in whatever climate change, we were already in kind of a unique area, right?
Right, absolutely. North Florida is the hottest part of Florida in the summer, both in terms of average daytime high temperatures, but also in terms of potential extremes. So the hottest temperatures ever in the state of Florida, as well as the coldest temperatures ever in the state of Florida, have happened in the central and eastern panhandle. The hottest day ever in Tallahassee was, I believe, in 2010, and it hit 105 degrees. You know, if you go back and you look at other major cities across Florida, just this summer, Tampa, for the first time ever, recorded a 100-degree day. Hmm. And I believe the Miami metro area has almost never seen a 100-degree day either. Yeah. And that really speaks to the tropical influence on the weather in Central and South Florida being much greater than in North Florida. So, you know, for instance, in Miami, down at around 25 degrees north latitude, you get pretty strong trade winds out of the east blowing east to west. And that's a very typical tropical weather pattern. It's the same weather pattern that you have in Puerto Rico or the Virgin Islands or the Lesser Antilles. You get these, you know, basically trade winds that blow through the summer months. And those trade winds stop the extremes in heat that we can see in North Florida because, you know, the water temperatures historically, you know, in the Bahamas, they're in the mid-80s. So it never can get too high above, you know, that water temperature. Now, the flip side of that is, of course, the temperature can't get too far below what the nearby water temperature is either. So, you know, typical summer day in Miami, historically, high of 90, low of 76. Typical summer day in Tallahassee is much more variable. If the winds are out of the north and you don't have that Gulf moisture influence, you know, that's how you get those days where the high temperature is 100 degrees or more. Now, you know, obviously that's always been a historical possibility, but we are seeing increased frequency of those temperature extremes, days of 100 or greater, over the last two or three decades.
And drought too, right? Or is that my perception where I see where, you know, I remember just as a gardener, I look at my plants in the garden and it didn't rain for 6 weeks, like maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And you know, are we experiencing more drought too, and longer and harsher droughts?
We are. And one of the big reasons for that is one of the fingerprints of climate change is an increased prevalence of La Nina versus El Nino events. Now, just to provide some context for listeners here, La Nina and El Nino refers to sea surface temperature anomalies in the equatorial Pacific Ocean, specifically the central equatorial Pacific. We're talking southwest of Hawaii. We're talking the vicinity of the International Dateline. So this is far from Florida. And you might be wondering, okay, great. Why am I talking about sea surface temperatures along the International Dateline? Well, that's because sea surface temperatures in that area are kind of like a climate pacemaker. They really set the tone for weather patterns worldwide, including in North America. So historically, models that have tried to project global weather patterns forward with anthropogenic warming influences have really split on, is there going to be more El Nino? Is there going to be more La Nina? This is sensitive stuff. It's a feedback between ocean and atmospheric circulations. And it's tough for models to get that right. Observationally, however, if you go back and you look at the last 40 years, one of the only places on Earth where average sea surface temperatures are not getting warmer is right in that region where we define El Nino or La Nina events. So bottom line, what that means is, got the global oceans are getting way warmer, and you've got this little patch of the Pacific that sets the tone for global climate that's actually trending cooler. Huh. So that increased contrast is leading to more frequent La Nina events. We had a 3-year La Nina that lasted between 2020 and 2023. We had a 1-year El Nino event in 2023 that faded out. And then last winter, we had yet another La Nina event, and we may well dip back into weak La Nina conditions again in the fall of 2025 winter of 2026. So five La Niñas in 6 years. Very unusual historically. We've never actually done that before. There's only other two instances where there's been three consecutive years of La Niña, looking back at the historical record as well. So La Niña is linked to a global weather pattern that tends to lead to high pressure systems over the southeastern United States in the fall and going into winter, and high pressure that's stable air, that's warmer than average temperatures, and it's usually promotes drier than average conditions. So unfortunately, La Niña events also promote higher risk of hurricane landfalls in the continental United States generally, but it seems seemingly specifically here along the northern Gulf Coast as well. So increased drought prevalence is likely linked to that increased frequency of La Niña events that we're seeing here over the past few decades.
Sounds like a lot of what you're saying sounds like a lot of unprecedented things happening lately. Does that make it kind of harder to predict, to model what's coming up?
It is, because, you know, when I went through academia and I graduated with a doctorate degree in meteorology from FSU in 2015. Mm-hmm. And what I studied in, you know, academia was hurricane history. That was my focus, was identifying why are some hurricane seasons more active from the perspective of United States landfalls than other hurricane seasons. So you can have a very busy hurricane season that has few impacts. No one remembers the 2010 hurricane season, despite there being 19 named storms, 12 hurricanes, and six major hurricanes, because none of them hit land. Hmm. We care about landfalls. It's where people and things are that really matter. So I went in and I tried to look at the historical record and identify, you know, what is it that drives that risk, that those risks economically, the risk to people, and, you know, how predictable is that? So it's very frustrating for me as, you know, as a hurricane historian and a, you know, climatologist to be seeing these conditions that are not reflected in the historical record, you know, and I'm a forecaster too. And I'm down getting my hands dirty, you know, every day making forecasts for agricultural interests. I'm writing hurricane forecasts, you know, for the Democrat and for my newsletter. And, you know, so I'm down in the weeds, you know, day to day here. And there's lots of things that are happening that, you know, we don't have great historical precedence for. There's more things that are possible in weather than are dreamt of in climatology, unfortunately. We're just changing that kind of what I would call putting the statistician's hat on, the background distribution that we're drawing from is changing, mm-hmm. you know, potentially due to some natural influences, but there's an anthropogenic strong anthropogenic fingerprint on it as well.
Gotcha. And so I was looking at the Weather Tiger website. So you use proprietary algorithms. So talk about the technology now that's used and it, A, how it's helping you, this kind of new technology, but also how much more public-facing a lot of this technology has become. And you see a lot more people posting, you know, spaghetti maps and all this. Just talk about how technology is changing sort of the face of meteorology and meteorology as perceived in the public.
Sure. Well, what I'm doing at WeatherTiger primarily is I'm taking data sets that are being made available publicly through the National Weather Service, through NOAA. And by law, all those data sets, any data that the NWS or NOAA are generating must be made available to the public at no charge. But there's a profusion of data. There's far more data available than we're able to make sense out of. Currently we have. So what I'm doing is I'm going into those data sets and I'm using my, you know, scientific training from, you know, my academic life to responsibly extract insights from that data set and turn them into forecasts that are useful and usable for my clients. You know, and my clients can include, you know, people who are reading the newspaper or reading my Substack newsletter, or, you know, the clients that I'm working with in agricultural meteorology. So what I'm doing is I'm going back and I'm identifying the patterns and other instances where highly impactful weather has occurred and making probabilistic forecasts about how busy is hurricane season going to be from a landfall perspective based on that information. What fingerprints can we go back and we look at as things that have reliably and consistently provided us skill in being able to say this is going to be a bad hurricane season or this is going to be a not so bad hurricane season. You know, and that democratization of data, I mean, it's a great thing. It's what I've made my career on, basically. The flip side of that is that with so much data available, if you do not have a scientific background, if you do not have the scientific training, or, I mean, let's take a step further back. If you are a bad actor who's looking to construct a narrative for hyping up, you know, extreme events or making irresponsible predictions to scare people, you certainly have the ability to do that with the wide variety of weather models and modeling data that's available. So, you know, great example, just, you know, out there right now, we have what I think just became Hurricane Aaron.
Right.
You know, there was chatter from social meteorologists that, you know, Aaron was going to be a threat to Florida. And that just, there never was the case. That was always something that was an extreme outlier possibility. But if you were just perusing social media, it wouldn't feel like that to you. You'd have your emotions played upon to feel fear, to be afraid that this is going to be a highly impactful event. When right. in fact, there really was never, you know, more than a 10% chance of any significant weather impacts on the U.S. East Coast. So, you know, as I like to say, bad information can circle the globe before good information puts its pants on.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of what I'm doing is just, you know, kind of fighting these rear guard actions to, you know, say, no, you know, this is kind of the responsible take on this.
Right. And working in media, I think we always talk about media literacy. There are so many sources of any kind of information. And so for weather, I mean, how do we judge what's a quality weather source compared to, something that's more preying on our negative emotions?
Well, you know, the great thing about weather is it's a pretty short fused system when you're making predictions. It's very prediction based, and you get to have a W or an L in a week or two.
Yeah.
So I would urge listeners to keep track of the wins and losses of the weather data sources that they're relying on. You know, I mean, no forecaster is perfect. I certainly have, you know, made errors and made mistakes. It's just part of the job. There's an inherent uncertainty into making forecasts. And a good forecaster, the job of a good forecaster is to communicate that uncertainty, communicate the different possible outcomes, and, you know, balance that by, you know, you also want to say something useful that someone can use to make a decision. So you don't want to say everything is a possibility. But,
yeah,
you know, essentially you do need to balance those two things, the usefulness with the, you know, possibility that you could be wrong and you don't want to be an overconfident forecaster. But at the same time, you know, if your forecast source is saying and alerting you to things over and over again that don't happen, that are scary, that are frightening, that are extreme, that's an L. Keep track of that. Don't follow data sources that are leading you astray over and over again.
Our conversations continued, and we covered a good bit of research into our local area. You can catch the rest of it on the Coast to Canopy podcast or with visuals at wfsu.org/ecologyblog.